When wolves disappeared from Iowa, they left a vacancy that coyotes have been eager to fill. But as wolves have returned to other parts of the United States, we've learned that their impact on the ecosystem is dramatic. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today, and we'll talk about wolves, coyotes, and foxes. We'll talk about their history in Iowa, how they live, what they eat, and how they coexist with man. We'll also talk about what we now understand about wolves as a keystone species, a species that plays a unique and crucial role in how an ecosystem functions. And we'll talk about whether or not they could ever return to Iowa. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Wolves disappeared from Iowa a long time ago, but coyotes and foxes have done well in the state. And this hour, we're going to talk about wild canines that either live in Iowa or used to live in Iowa with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Charity. How are you?
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure. Have you recovered from your vacation yet?
I'm mostly recovered, mostly That's recovered. Good. And Jim is referring to the fact that I just recently went to Isle Royale National Park, which is up in Lake Superior. It's a large island in Lake Superior. And it's a place where people have had an opportunity to study wolf populations for many years. Unfortunately, there are only two wolves left on the island right now, although that is supposed to change in the fairly near future.
Right.
But Jim, that's a place that you have spent a lot of time over the years. I've only gotten to go twice, but you've spent a lot of time on the island,
yeah,
haven't you?
I've been there 25 or 30 times, either backpacking or canoeing across a series of interior lakes on the island. This is an island, for those who are not familiar with Isle Royale National Park. It's as you said, in Lake Superior, in the Gitchigumi, the big lake. And it's about 40 miles long and on average about 10 miles wide. And it's an island that is about 20 miles at its closest point from the Minnesota shoreline, but it is officially part of Michigan, and that has to do with the politics back in the 1800s. I don't understand how this happened, but yeah. It is officially part of Michigan, but it is a national park, and the whole island is really devoted. There are no vehicles, per se, on the island. You can only get there by boat or by seaplane, and basically it's devoted to backpacking and to fishing along the shores. There is a lodge on the sort of northeast end of the island at Rock Harbor that people can come and stay overnight. They don't have to backpack, and there are several cabins in that area. So it's really a wilderness national park that is very, very special to me. I've had the great fortune to travel lots and lots of places all over the world. And it is still one of my very favorite wild places in the world. And in part, it's because of its wildlife history. And as you mentioned, it is a place that has, in fact, they have the longest running data set of predator-prey interactions, I think, anywhere in the world. And this is a large predator, the wolf, the timber wolf, and the prey is primarily moose, and this has been studied since the early 1950s by biologists, wildlife biologists from Minnesota and Michigan, primarily from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And the most recent one was Rolf Peterson, who has come to speak in Iowa a couple of times at universities. And they followed both the moose populations and the wolf populations. And I was there almost every year for, 20 years and backpacking there. And it was pretty obvious. When the moose population was high, you could see evidence of it. And in fact, in the 90s, when I was backpacking there, I was quite concerned because you saw moose everywhere, And the population was the winter overwintering population was nearing was over 2,000 animals on an island that size. That's really a high population, and the wolf population was declining at that point, and it was kind of nobody was quite sure why. And I looked in the middle of the summer, in mid-July, I'd be backpacking there with a group, and we looking, and they're browsing their winter browse, the stuff they need through the wintertime. And I kept predicting for a couple of years, I said, boy, this moose population is going to decline. And sure enough, we had a very, very difficult deep snow winter, and the moose population halved in 1 year. They fell from about 2,400 animals to 1,200 animals. So you had 1,200 moose die over the winter. And the following year, they halved again. So they were down to between 650 animals. And it was all due to the change in the availability of food and deep snows in the wintertime, making it very difficult for them to get around. It wasn't due directly to predation by wolves. But that predator-prey interaction has been, as I say, the longest data set of really any large predator-prey in the world, and it's really quite valuable. What has happened, of course, is that the wolf population in particular has declined to the point where there are just two wolves left. And they are non-breeding. They're closely related. They're either a father-daughter or a father-sister kind of a situation. They're not exactly sure. And they think what has happened, the prime idea is that they reach what's called a genetic bottleneck. In other words, they were so closely related that diseases that are recessive in the gene pool tended to come out, or not just diseases, but malformations and other things tended to express themselves. And so at very low survival rates and very small litter sizes.
Well, and this decline in the wolf population and the inbreeding was also, it was spurred by a parvo epidemic that took out a lot of the wolves on the island decades ago.
Right, right. Yeah, and that's always a problem. Yeah, island populations the world over, and there's a whole idea about what's called island biogeography. Islands are always a subset of the species that are on the nearby mainland. So the farther the island is from a mainland area, the fewer numbers of species that are there, both plants and animals. And in the case of Isle Royale, for example, there are no bears there, whereas there are bears all over Minnesota and Michigan and Canada and everything. But there are no bears on Isle Royale. There are a number of other species that are not there as well. And so the primary large prey species that is there are moose. Have in the past been a few deer, and perhaps were at one time, ancient times, probably caribou, woodland caribou. But it's really moose that are the primary population there. And how did they get there? Well, moose are strong swimmers. Wolves are strong swimmers. But 20 miles is a long ways to go for either species. So more than likely, they came over on what were called ice bridges during the wintertime. And Lake Superior would freeze, and animals would cross on the ice for various reasons, presumably low food populations on the mainland, or getting thrown out of territory, or all kinds of reasons. Maybe they're just curious, you know. So they would strike out across the ice and end up on Isle Royale. Well, the ice bridges, of course, are fewer and fewer and fewer because of global warming, and so you get very few years that have an ice bridge from the mainland to the island. And in fact, the last one was just a few years ago now, 5 or 6 years ago, and the one female that was she was the alpha female. She crossed the ice to the mainland and was killed on the mainland, and no wolves came back the other way.
Right, so it was a loss.
Yeah, it was a net loss for the island and certainly decreased the diversity. So it's a population that fluctuates. Any predator prey population over time, as the prey increases, the predators increase, and then as the prey population falls for various reasons, from maybe disease, from weather, from predation, combination of things. The predator population peaks and then falls as well. So it's this undulating relationship between predators and prey. The farther north you go, the simpler that predator-prey relationship is. In other words, there aren't a lot of other what are called buffer species sometimes for the predator to exist on. On Isle Royale, there are such things as beaver, for example. I don't know if you saw any.
I did, yes.
Yeah, you saw some beaver dams? Good. All right.
Met in beaver dams everywhere, and I got to see three beavers, too, but
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, and their populations have fluctuated as well, because as the moose populations would get low, or they would get younger, young moose populations are much harder to kill for wolves. They have a tough time bringing them down, and they're just faster, more resilient, like most young critters, humans included. They're tougher than the old crippled ones. And so as the moose population would go down, the predator, the wolves had a more difficult time preying on the moose. So they would switch to another species. And there aren't a lot of other species on Isle Royale that wolves can exist on. Beaver are one of them, and they would switch to beaver. So as the wolf population has gone down, the beaver population has gone up, which is really interesting. It's a fascinating relationship between and among species.
Well, and Isle Royale is sort of the perfect living laboratory to study the interaction between the predators and the prey. But I want to talk more about the ecosystem that is influenced by that relationship.
Yeah.
And that's something, and we're going to have to take a break here in just a moment, but that's something that we've really come to understand a great deal more about, not because of Isle Royale, but because of the reintroduction of wolves to Yellowstone National Park.
Yeah, and I think we'll see that on Isle Royale as well. It'll be fascinating to watch as, and we haven't said this yet, but wolves, after a number of years of decision-making, the National Park Service has finally decided to reintroduce a group of wolves, 25 to 30, I think is the number that most people are going with. And these will come from several populations to increase the genetic diversity of wolves. They will introduce them to the island over the next several years.
Right, beginning this fall,
yeah,
I believe.
It'll be fascinating to watch.
Absolutely. All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. This hour, we're talking about wild canines, wolves, coyotes, and foxes, with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. He's an emeritus associate professor of natural resource ecology and management at Iowa State University. And you are welcome to join our conversation with your questions and your experiences. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me this hour, wildlife biologist Jim Pease. And we're talking about wild canines this hour. We'll talk about coyotes and foxes that, of course, live in Iowa. But right now we're focusing on wolves, an animal that used to live in Iowa a long time ago. And we're talking about the impact that wolves have on their environment. And Jim, wolves are a keystone species.
Right.
And maybe you could explain for us a little bit about what that really means for a species to be a keystone species.
What happens is, with a keystone species, it's a species that impacts not just the species that it is directly in contact with, but it has this sort of cascade of effects over a whole a number of other species. Most keystone species are predators, but not always. Certainly in the Great Plains, bison were considered a keystone species because of their impacts not only on the predators, but their impacts on the vegetation, on the way they impacted human populations, et cetera, et cetera. So there's this cascade of effects on other species. And wolves are certainly a keystone species. And that has been proven most recently with the reintroduction of wolves to Yellowstone National Park. Now, wolves have had this long relationship with human beings that goes back centuries, probably millennia, and it has spawned all sorts of folklore in human society, from Little Red Riding Hood, et cetera, to you know, beliefs about wolves as spirit animals, et cetera, et cetera. So it's
and of course, man's best friend was domesticated from the wolf.
Right? Yeah, the dog. Yeah, exactly. So it's really fascinating. So we've had this long fascination. And it's really only been in the 20th century, since the 20th century, that we've become, that science has taken over. And this was started by Durwood Allen and then his student David Meach, who wrote a book called The Wolf and several other books since. And then Rolf Peterson and his work on Isle Royale and others since. And the fascination with wolves has there seems to have been no middle ground. It was either you love them or you hate them. In 20th century society anyway, so there's still that. We see that in the West when wolves were reintroduced to Yellowstone, and there was a conflict particularly between livestock owners and people who wanted to reintroduce wolves to Yellowstone. Well, it turns out that most biologists could not even predict sort of how it affected the whole ecosystem of Yellowstone, not just the predator and their prey, or the predator and surrounding landowners. It really impacted the whole ecosystem, and in very, very interesting ways. Thinking back on it, it makes a lot of sense. What has happened in Yellowstone, for example, is the presence of wolves has changed the fundamental behavior of their prey species, which in Yellowstone are some bison, for sure, particularly young bison, but elk as well. And elk populations had grown, especially since the fires in 1980 of Yellowstone and this rapid expansion of aspen tree populations and sapling populations and willows. And so the elk responded to this, and boy, they were doing really well. Well, wolves were reintroduced, and it changed the behavior of the elk. The elk, instead of being in huge herds, it's sort of counterintuitive, but rather than being in one large herd, they broke up into smaller herds, and they tended not to stay in one area. Whenever a grazing and browsing animal stays in one area, they tend, to overgraze and overbrowse that area down until there's nothing there for them to eat, and then they sort of move on. Well, the wolves kept them on the move. And so the grazing and browsing was spread out more equally. They were in smaller herds, and they were in reduced numbers because the wolves were taking a significant number of elk. Well, what happened? Well, the grasses recovered, the willows recovered in some areas. Other species that depended on those, like beaver, for example, were able to survive because they had food now. They depend on these woody species like aspen and willow. And they were able to build dams, creating wetlands, which impacted other species. So songbird populations have gone up, the beaver populations, small mammal populations, all of them have been impacted very positively by this introduction of one keystone species, that being the wolf, that thereby reduced the numbers of elk and spread them around more.
Well, and it's so interesting to see how the vegetation changes, because,
right,
of course, that's the last thing you think of when you think of wolves.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It is fascinating. They really, I think a few biologists thought this would happen, but not to the extent that it has. It's really surprised a lot of people, the impacts over the whole ecosystem. And I think the same will happen on Isle Royale. The vegetation there that the moose feed on is a yew, and they browse on woody vegetation, especially in the wintertime. They depend on that woody browse. And trees up to the size of, say, your forearm can be, with a large moose, will literally walk them down. They'll put that tree between their two front feet and and just kind of bulldoze it down, walk it down, and they eat the upper branches in. And if it doesn't break, those branches, it springs back up, and those branches then resprout. But in the summertime, if they're eating all that woody browse, boy, it will definitely change their winter food habits. They can't do that. The trees get up to a certain size, they can't walk them down anymore. So the wolves on there will certainly impact. I think they'll have this cascade effect on lots of species. We'll see that not only on the moose, but on other species that are already there. Now, again, this is an island population, so it's a, you know, it's a subset of the species that are on the mainland. But it's an important subset, and so it'll be interesting to watch what happens.
Now, we've seen, of course, wolves come back in Minnesota, and right. wolves Wisconsin. Come back in Wisconsin right. and in Michigan. Mm-hmm. And wolves, of course, used to live in Iowa. Yeah. Now, the Iowa landscape is unique because it has been so altered right. by man. Right. Do you think that we'll ever see wolves living in Iowa again?
Well, we occasionally see wolves passing through Iowa. In fact, over the past several years, there have been a couple documented, actually confirmed, wolves that have been shot by coyote hunters, mistaken them for a very large coyote, and we'll talk about coyotes in a minute here. But I don't believe that this landscape in Iowa... most of the landscape in Iowa, I should say, will being as altered as it is, will ever support a breeding population of wolves. We might have a small pack or a very small pack or a family of wolves, maybe in northeastern Iowa, Allamakee County. It makes most sense there because they're closest to existing wolf packs in Wisconsin and in southeastern Minnesota. And that's usually where we get sightings of apparently wolves and sometimes confirmed sightings. But really, we only average a couple of year of confirmed sightings, a couple per year of confirmed sightings of wolves in Iowa. I don't think the landscape here, we have so many roads. That's the other thing is that we are, most of the state is checkerboarded with roads every mile on the section lines and even the half section lines in many cases for secondary roads. So I think the number of roads, the absence of continuous cover except along the river systems and the absence of enough particularly wooded cover in most of the state except along our rivers, I think will prevent any long-term population of wolves ever establishing themselves again in Iowa. They do well with deer populations. That's why they came back in Wisconsin and Minnesota. As deer populations increased, wolves increased, particularly in Wisconsin, in direct response to deer. And, that's why we get occasionally wolves in Iowa, but I don't think the landscape is such that they'll ever be able to reestablish here unless that landscape changes significantly.
Let's talk about coyotes, because when wolves disappeared from most of the continental United right. States, coyotes, a smaller canine, really took that opportunity. They are opportunists. They are extremely flexible about where they live and adaptable. Right. And so the coyote population in the United States, in Iowa, is pretty large, right?
Oh yeah, it's very large. And in fact, coyotes were primarily, until Euro-American settlement moved west of the Mississippi and wiped out wolf populations. Basically, Iowa's wolves were gone by the 1880s. Very, very quickly, wolves, bears, cougars were all sort of disappeared from the Iowa landscape. They were viewed as competitors and all sorts of reasons they disappeared. But people killed them, basically, and wouldn't allow them to. There were bounties and all kinds of things. So those big apex predators disappeared very quickly. And coyotes, being primarily a Western species, they were mostly in the Great Plains and west of there. They gradually moved eastward. Not so gradually, actually. They came up pretty quickly. They, as you said, they're opportunistic. they saw an open niche. There were prey that weren't being used. Plus, they're competitors with wolves. Where wolf populations are well established, coyote populations tend to be lower, and because wolves will prey on them, and they tend to be a little less well established, shall we say. So in Yellowstone, the coyote population has changed dramatically since wolves were reintroduced there.
Well, and it's interesting that they are competitors, but yeah. they're not keystone species in the same way.
Right.
And coyotes don't necessarily prey on the same things that wolves prey on. I mean, there's some overlap. But
very little, though. Yeah, yeah. On what are called medium-sized predators or prey, things like beaver, for example, or raccoons, rabbits, that sort of thing. Wolves will take them occasionally, particularly as a buffer when they can't catch or if they're incapable of. They're too small. Wolves are. Pack hunting animals, whereas coyotes tend to be more solitary hunting, although you may find family groups occasionally hunting together with coyotes. So they really go after different size of prey. There's some overlap in deer. Coyotes can't take adult, healthy deer for the most part, but they can take a lot of fawns. So there's overlap in prey of that size. But most of the small prey, they're not. It's really more competition from, gee, I don't like having you around. And wolves seem to have kept dominant theory is that wolves sort of kept coyotes into the Great Plains where their prey were more common, wolves were not able to coyotes were not able to invade most of eastern North America. Now coyotes are all over the place from all over North America, except for the very northern part of Canada. They're into Central and South America, or Northern South America, but especially Central America.
And they even can live in our urban places.
Absolutely. In fact, the coyotes are so adaptable in terms of their prey and in terms of their food supply. Certainly, their primary, if you look at all the food habit studies on coyotes, their primary prey are things like rabbits, some rodents, some mice and that sort of thing. But in urban areas, they switch that to these middle-sized prey, including house cats, or wild cats anyway, cats that are let outdoors, small dogs, rabbits, dog food, cat food left outside. They'll even scavenge in garbage cans. There's a study in Chicago where they actually radio collared about 170 coyotes in the city of Chicago. We're talking in the urban area. And as a result of that, they never anticipated radio collaring that many, but they did. And they, as a result of that, following them around and watching their movements, they're very, very, they tend to have been very nocturnal, whereas in wild areas, probably in the Great Plains, they tended to be much more diurnal out during the daytime. Around people, they tend to try to avoid us, and so they've become very nocturnal. But they estimate the population in the city of Chicago to be over 2,000 coyotes in the city of Chicago.
Wow.
So it shouldn't be surprising at all that we have an increasing number of sightings of coyotes within urban areas and small towns in the state of Iowa. The prey is there, ground squirrels, rabbits, chipmunks, squirrels, all those small, medium-sized prey items. And they've learned to live in the presence of humans, raiding our garbage cans occasionally, cats that are left out, small dogs, that sort of thing as well. So it shouldn't be surprising to us that they're in the state of Iowa and doing very, very well, even in our most urban areas.
Now, you mentioned humans' problematic relationship with wolves.
Mm.
And I admit I love coyotes, and
yeah.
I get a thrill every time I see one, every time I hear coyotes
yeah.
at night, which is one of my favorite things.
You bet.
But, people associate them with wolves. People have a lot of fear of these creatures.
Yeah, and part of that, again, it comes from our long sort of history, mixed history with the dog family. Our ancestors domesticated wolves, and all the breeds of dogs that we have came from the wolf line someplace. And that's the positive side of it. The negative side of it is we have all of this folklore that goes with, oh, they've killed humans, blah, blah, blah. And it just and it goes to coyotes as well. You look at the folklore, even in Native American folklore, with the coyote is the wily one, the one that all the stories come from, that the coyote is the one who does all of this mischief that it takes place in society. They don't, and they sort of certain people who are very clever, they would call them like a coyote as well. So, there's a long mixed history with wolves and coyotes.
We'll take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. This hour, we're talking about wild canines, wolves, coyotes, and fox with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. You are welcome to join the conversation. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me today, Jim Pease, Emeritus Associate Professor of Natural Resource Ecology and Management at Iowa State University. And we're talking about wild canines this hour. We talked a lot about wolves, which, of course, once lived in Iowa. We're talking about coyotes. We'll talk about fox in just a few minutes. So, Jim, we were talking about the somewhat problematic relationship that a lot of people have with coyotes. And there's a long, long history to that as well, and an effort to extirpate the species really from many parts the United States. What is the status of coyotes in Iowa right now? I mean, a lot of us live with them. Are they considered to be a nuisance species?
Well, in some urban areas, they are actually increasingly seem to be, certain individuals anyway, seem to be becoming nuisances in some urban areas. And I say a nuisance, not so much in terms that they raid our garbage, all kinds of things, raid garbage that's left out, but in there are certain individuals seem to be in certain areas more and more accustomed to human beings, and are coming out in the daytime rather than at night, show a lack of fear of humans. They tend to be in our backyards. So there's a concern, and I think a reasonable concern. Anytime a wild animal becomes acclimatized to humans, there are more potential problems. Most of this, I think, can be traced to the fact that humans have acted badly in terms of encouraging that that climatization to humans. They leave dog food or cat food out, or in a few rare cases, they have intentionally left food out for coyotes, and that's a bad practice. It's a really bad practice. The more you acclimatize them to human food or to human-provided food, the greater the chance that that animal will become a problem and will have to be removed or killed later on. So it's really a bad practice.
Also attracts many other species.
Oh, yeah.
If you leave food outside, you're going to have skunks and raccoons and all kinds of things, and possums coming into your yard to partake.
Right, and it's just a really bad thing to do. So basically, feed your pets inside. Don't leave food outside overnight. I've had people call me when I was extension wildlife specialist and say, "Gee, I've got One woman called me and said the raccoons have learned how to use the pet door into our kitchen, and they feed with our dogs and cats in the kitchen. Is there a problem with that, do you think? And I said, yeah, I think there's a real problem with that. It's a little too close. They spread disease. They can become very aggressive.
Well, and if they get, they're wild animals.
Absolutely.
If they get frightened.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's just crazy. I said, nail that door shut. So anyway, anytime you have a wild animal that becomes so accustomed to humans that they're around them all the time, it's a potential problem. And there seem to be at least more reports of that coming to police departments, and that it sometimes is a young animal that just doesn't know any better. It's parents have maybe abandoned it, or more likely been killed by a car or something like that, especially living in urban areas that happens. The young animals haven't learned to be afraid of humans. There seem to be increasing reports of that. So the population of coyotes in Iowa, and in fact across the nation, despite incredible efforts in the West to extirpate them from states where they were preying on sheep, for example, in wild pastures in particular, that was the big effort in California and in a lot of Western states where there were large sheep flocks. And coyotes were a major problem because once they get a taste of that, a sheep is a lot easier to run down, a lamb especially, to run down and kill than any other wild critter, or especially a deer or something like that. So it really is much easier to kill a sheep. So
a
real problem.
Right. A lot of studies have also shown that a lot of the predation of domestic animals is actually performed by domestic animals.
Right.
It's actually being performed by dogs.
Yeah, exactly.
As opposed to coyotes. So
or
they've taken the blame for a lot.
They sure have. Yeah, but nevertheless, there were lots of efforts to extirpate them, mm-hmm. and the coyote populations are doing just fine practically everywhere.
And for the most part seem to be able to live in an environment infested by humans,
absolutely,
without a lot of conflict.
That's exactly right. For the most part, no conflict at all. I'm just pointing out some of the potential areas of conflict so that people don't get the idea that, we can have them all over in our backyards and with our kids and pets. And no, they're looking for prey.
Right. They are wild animals.
Yeah, they are wild critters. And while the coyote, I should say, is usually at the shoulder, under 2 feet high at the shoulders, whereas a wolf is 30 inches or more. So they're much smaller than a wolf. But there are many instances of a cross between domestic dogs and coyotes. It's called a coy dog. And the reason we know this happens is that coyotes in the wild only come into estrus, female coyotes only come in to breeding condition once a year, and that's usually in January, February, so that they have their pups in March or April in the early spring when the prey are much more available. Well, coy dogs, of course, actually can breed year-round, and coy dogs, the cross, the hybrid between the two, actually comes into estrus twice a year, so they have pups twice a year, so it's very easy to tell the difference. And they do look usually a little bit different, but they have that domesticated dog's lack of fear of humans. And so much of the predation in a study that I was involved in northern Alberta with a friend of mine, a fellow student in college, about 90% of the predation on livestock there was due to coy dogs, not to coyotes or to wolves. And coy dogs have many of them have what are called hybrid vigor, so they're a little bigger than coyotes. But the local folks often called them brush wolves, they make up all these names for this hybrid species. So that happens as well, and very much of the predation is not caused by coyotes, but by coy dogs or by dogs, Yeah.
Right. Another great reason to have your pet spayed or
neutered. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, let's get to the phones. John is on the line, and Marion has a question. Hi, John.
Hello.
What's your question?
Well, Jim mentioned coyotes eating domestic cats, and I just wondered if there was any documented evidence of that there was, because cats, they got a lot of sharp claws and teeth, and I just wondered.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of evidence. In fact, in urban areas, one of their prime prey species is, they've done food habit studies, are feral cats, basically. And coyotes have taken up where people think it's in the best interest of the feral cat population to feed them. And there are places like this across the U.S. and Canada. It just happens. Coyotes that get into that area tend to kill out the feral cat population and continue to eat the cat food that's provided. So, yeah, there's a lot of documented evidence that cats that are left to roam on their own at night, even so-called domesticated cats, not only do they kill a lot of birds and that, but they're subject to predation by both great horned owls and certainly very heavily by coyotes.
Well, and the approach that coyotes take to killing prey often is to snap the neck
right.
quickly, so it's
right.
they're not facing those claws necessarily.
Right.
I feel like we're shorting Fox this hour.
Yes.
We only have a few minutes left to talk about them, and they're such unusual creatures. I mean, they are a member of this canine family,
yeah.
but they are so unlike wolves and coyotes.
Yeah, well, they're much, much smaller. They do not, at most, they'll hunt in family groups. Otherwise, they are solitary hunters. They're basically, whereas a wolf can be 50 to 100 pounds, coyotes are 25 to 40 pounds, usually 45, maybe very large ones. We're talking big is a 10 to 12 pound fox. These are much, much smaller.
They look bigger than they are with those long, long tails.
Yeah, long tails and very long fur on them. And so they do look much bigger than they are, but they're really the size of a house cat. They really are not much bigger than that. Little longer legs, but really, being a smaller canid, they prey on smaller things like mice, voles, ground squirrels, certainly. There's some overlap, but very little overlap between them. And they eat a lot of berries, a lot of insects, even worms, so grubs, things like that. So they really have we see the difference in size, a difference in prey size, a difference in weight. And so while there's overlap between all three of these species, the foxes really are the smaller prey items. There are also a red fox. We have in Iowa two species of foxes. A lot of people don't realize this, but we have the red fox is the one that is most commonly seen. And that's an animal primarily of grasslands and grassland edges. So we see them a lot along in pasture country. They live very well in cities. I know of around the Iowa State University campus. At one time, I knew of three different dens with vixens in them. So there were three different females that had just here on the campus. And they would hunt the central campus in the middle of the night.
Right, and they were rarely seen, I'm
very
sure.
Very rarely seen, yeah. Yeah, you had to, well, if you were coming to work at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, you might see one trotting across campus. That has happened. But in general, they were very rarely seen, and they prey on very different things. The other fox we have, though, in Iowa, that is similar, certainly, is the gray fox. The gray fox is more restricted to our woodlands. So gray fox populations, because we have fewer woodlands, it's a prairie state, our gray foxes are more of a eastern third of Iowa, southern Iowa, restricted to our wooded areas. And gray foxes actually not only hunt some of the same things, but they because they live in the woods more, they'll change to woodland species. They also climb trees. I've seen it once, a gray fox coming down a tree. I did this double take as I came around another tree and saw this large animal going down this tree. I thought, my gosh, what is that? And sure enough, it was a gray fox. And this is in the Des Moines River Valley. So it really is a very different critter, occupies a different sort of habitat within the state, doesn't cross with, as far as we know, with red fox. Although they're certainly the same family, they're really fundamentally very, very different critters.
Now, fox, as I mentioned, you may not see them very often, but you were talking about three dens on campus.
I
mean, they do seem to, again, be an incredibly adaptable species that can live among us without necessarily interacting. I love to look for fox scat because obviously you see fox scat a lot more often than you see foxes.
Right.
But it helps you know that they're there.
Yeah, it does. And actually, people can, if you're near a den site, you'll learn that there's a certain smell that foxes have.
And, a little bit skunky.
A little skunky, and their dens, you may mistake it, in fact, for skunk, but it's not. It has a different, more sort of acrid smell to me than skunk does. And they are, some people smell them before they see them. But they're red fox very commonly will den on roadsides. And the females are quite interesting because they, unlike... wolves and coyotes that tend to have a den same place every year. Foxes will have two or three dens, and they may the young foxes are in the den. If they feel that is been discovered by someone, they may move them to one of their other two or three other dens while they're quite young, while they're still in the den, not out running around. They'll say, it's time to move. This isn't safe anymore. So they adapt to human presence very well by moving those young around. They also will feed a lot more than the other two larger species on berries. So you'll often find fox scat, particularly this time of year or a little earlier in July when we had berries galore of all kinds, raspberries in particular, and gooseberries and that's those kinds of things were highly available, and the foxes will feed on those readily. So their scat often has lots more berries in it than coyotes do.
Well, and you mentioned that the fox on the Iowa State campus might hunt in the middle of the night, but what are their active times of day?
Usually, these are diurnal critters. Given their what they would prefer to do, they hunt during the daytime. They hunt after mice. They'll use their noses that are very, very good at finding mice and mice dens and those sorts of things to jump on mice from above. You'll see this. You can see this on a lot of the nature channels. Where a mouse is, or a fox is jumping into the snow head first and coming up with a vole or something. They have a keen sense of hearing as well, but they tend to hunt during the day. But in reaction to humans, particularly in a highly developed area like urban areas, foxes are there, but they're much more nocturnal than they would be under normal circumstances.
Well, and I my observation is that I think they see us a whole lot more than we see them. There's a fox that lives near me, and I see it sometimes watching me and my dogs, and the dogs have never seen it.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
I suspect it sees me every day.
Absolutely. Yeah, they're very, very keen observers of their environment. They'll often sit in the den entrance or in a bush nearby and just watch what's going by. And if these are along bike trails and that, you're absolutely right. They'll watch us more than we watch them.
So. And if you do get to see them, they're fascinating to watch.
Yeah, beautiful.
Jim Pease, we could have talked for a couple more hours.
Yeah, I think
so. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wildlife biologist Jim Pease. He comes by every couple of months to talk about wild creatures and wild places with us. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We'll be right back.